This CLE course is based on the New York State appellate decisions that were released in June of 2019. The summaries of cases that are the basis of this CLE were originally posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in June 2019, and they have since been compiled into an organized update pamphlet. And it is that update pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this CLE course. The pamphlet is available on the New York Appellate Digest website. First case is Krakowski on page 8 of the update pamphlet, June 2019 Civil Procedure Update Pamphlet. It has to do with amending a complaint. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to amend its complaint, which originally stemmed from the encroachment of defendant's pipes, should have been granted despite the passage of 6 years during which a default judgment was vacated. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court should have granted that branch of the plaintiff's cross motion, which was for leave to amend the complaint. Permission to amend a pleading should be freely given, citing CPLR 3025 subdivision B. Where the proposed amendment is neither palpably insufficient nor patently devoid of merit, and there's no evidence that the amendment would prejudice or surprise the opposing party. Mere lateness is not a basis for denying an amendment. It must be lateness coupled with significant prejudice to the other side, the very elements of the Latches Doctrine. The burden of establishing prejudice is on the party opposing the amendment. Here, notwithstanding the lengthy gap in time between the commencement of the action and plaintiff's cross motion for leave to amend the complaint, the defendant has made no showing that it was surprised by the new allegations or would be significantly prejudiced. Some portion of that delay is attributed to the defendant's effort to vacate its default and the party's subsequent motion practice and negotiations, and there's no contention that discovery has been concluded." Next is Matter of Ball versus Town of Ballston on pages 9 and 10. It deals with a motion to intervene in an Article 78 proceeding. It also deals with the power of the Commissioner of Agriculture and Markets to contest a resolution enacted by a town board. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held petitioner, the Commissioner of Agriculture and Markets, had the authority to enforce a 2004 Town Board resolution which restricted the use of water provided by a water main to existing residential uses and agricultural uses. In 2016, the Town Board passed a resolution allowing a connection with the water main to service a new residential subdivision. The commissioner brought an Article 78 proceeding to enforce the 2004 resolution, and the developers of the residential subdivision were properly allowed to intervene. The court wrote, "Supreme Court did not abuse its discretion in permitting the developers to intervene. Petitioner may well be correct that the developers do not have standing to bring a suit to challenge his determination, but the bases for permissive intervention are broader than they are for standing to originate the proceeding. The developers have property interests that will be impacted should petitioner succeed, and all share the view of the town and the respondent town supervisor that petitioner lacks authority to enforce restrictions on water main access that the town board later attempted to vitiate. In our view, this is sufficient to render them interested persons who can at least intervene with regard to that portion of the petition complaint founded upon CPLR Article 78. And then the court moved on to the merits. A local government enjoys broad autonomy under the Home Rule provision of the New York Constitution, but that autonomy does not extend to actions that conflict with the Constitution or any general law. Among the general laws of New York is Agriculture and Markets Law, Article 25-AA, which was enacted upon a finding that many of the agricultural lands in New York State are in jeopardy of being lost for any agricultural purposes due to local land use regulations inhibiting farming, as well as various other deleterious side effects resulting from the extension of non-agricultural development into farm areas. Petitioner was within his rights to order the town to comply with the 2004 resolution following an investigation, and upon the town's failure to seek review of his determination and refusal to comply with it, commence the present enforcement litigation. Next is matter of D'Souza on page 10. It has to do with the procedural requirements of an Article 78 action. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petition seeking review of the Zoning Board's denial of variances should not have been dismissed on the ground that petitioner did not provide a transcript of the proceedings. CPLR 7804 requires that the respondent provide the transcript. In this case, the respondent was the Board of Appeals of the Town of Hempstead. Next is matter of KEIS, K-E-I-S, on page 11. It has to do with the appealability of an ex parte order, and the underlying action involved the civil rights law. Second Department held petitioner's application to change his race/nationality from Black African American to Moor Americas Aboriginal was properly denied. The court noted that an ex parte order is not appealable, but the court deemed the notices of appeal to be applications for leave to appeal pursuant to CPLR 5704, subdivision A. The court wrote, an ex parte order is not appealable. However, under the circumstances of this case, we deem it appropriate to treat the instant notices of appeal as applications for review pursuant to CPLR 5704, subdivision A. Then, with respect to the merits, the court wrote, we agree with the Supreme Court's denial of that branch of the petition which was to change the petitioner's race/nationality, as the petitioner presented no authority for the court to grant such relief. Article 6 of the Civil Rights Law, which governs petitions for leave to assume another name, does not provide such authority. A person's race is a matter of self-identification. As to nationality, the sole means by which the petitioner may renounce his nationality as a United States citizen is to satisfy one of the conditions set forth in 8 U.S.C. section 1481, subdivision A. The petitioner made no showing that he met any of these conditions. Next is Pangea Capital Management on pages 11 and 12. It's a Court of Appeals case. It deals with whether the award of marital property in a divorce makes one spouse the creditor or the judgment creditor of the other spouse. The Court of Appeals, in a full opinion by Judge Wilson, held the 2015 judgment of divorce, which awarded the wife, Andrea, a percentage of marital property, which was a home worth $5 million, did not make Andrea a judgment creditor, such that the failure to docket the judgment of divorce gave priority to Pangea Capital Management, which was a judgment creditor and who had docketed a 2016 judgment. The court wrote, the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has certified the following question to us. If an entered divorce judgment grants a spouse an interest in real property pursuant to Domestic Relations Law Section 236, and the spouse does not docket the divorce judgment in the county where the property is located, is the spouse's interest subject to attachment by a subsequent judgment creditor that has docketed its judgment and seeks to execute against the property? We answer that question in the negative. The court went on to say, marital assets are not owned by one spouse or another, and the dissolution of a marriage involving the division of marital assets does not render one ex-spouse the creditor of another. Andrea, therefore, cannot properly be considered a judgment creditor of John, her ex-husband. Therefore, CPLR 5203, subdivision A, by its plain terms, has no application here, and Pangaea can claim no priority. Next is Matter of Armand Gustav on pages 12 and 13. It deals with the different requirements for dealing with an Article 78 petition and the declaratory judgment when both of those are brought together. Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, held that the Article 78 petition for a hardship waiver to allow petitioner to build a single-family residence on property within the core preservation area of the Long Island Central Pines Barrens was properly denied. However, the accompanying declaratory judgment action, alleging the denial of the waiver was an unconstitutional taking, should not have been summarily dismissed by the judge absent a motion for that relief. The court wrote, in a hybrid proceeding and action, separate rules apply to those causes of action which are asserted pursuant to CPLR Article 78 on the one hand, and those to recover damages and for declaratory relief on the other hand. The Supreme Court may not employ the summary procedure applicable to a CPLR Article 78 cause of action to dispose of causes of action to recover damages or seeking a declaratory judgment. Where no party makes a request for a summary determination of the causes of action which seek to recover damages or declaratory relief, it is error for the Supreme Court to summarily dispose of those causes of action. Next is Nesbitt, which is on pages 13 and 14. It deals with a discovery issue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's request for discovery of alcohol/drug treatment/mental health information/HIV-related information in this slip-and-fall case was not supported by evidence of a compelling need. The court wrote, a party must provide duly executed and acknowledged written authorizations for the release of pertinent medical records under the liberal discovery provisions of the CPLR when that party has waived the physician-patient privilege by affirmatively putting his or her physical or mental condition in issue. However, Public Health Law Section 2785 Subdivision 1 provides, notwithstanding any other provision of law, no court shall issue an order for the disclosure of confidential HIV-related information. And the only exception to that prohibition that is pertinent in this case requires an application showing a compelling need for disclosure of the information for the adjudication of a criminal or civil proceeding, and that is Public Health Law Section 2785, Subdivision 2A. Here the defendants failed to proffer any showing of a compelling need for disclosure related to HIV-related information. Further, the defendants failed to submit an expert affidavit or any other evidence that would establish a connection between alcohol/drug treatment/mental health information/HIV-related information and the cause of the accident, and failed to make any effort to link any such information to the plaintiff's ability to recover from his injuries or his prognosis for future enjoyment of life. Next is MC versus City of New York. It's on page 14, another discovery case. It has to do with a third-party assault, student-on-student assault, and the suit is against the school district. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that discovery in this third-party assault slash negligent supervision case should not have been restricted to prior sexual assaults in the school and prior assaults between the student perpetrator and the student plaintiff. The court wrote, we disagree with the Supreme Court's determination that the defendants were only required to provide records pertaining to assaults of a sexual nature and all assaults of any nature between infant plaintiff and the student alleged to have sexually assaulted the infant plaintiff. Evidence of prior assaults at the school, particularly any assaults in the stairwell where the subject incident occurred, may be sufficient to establish that the defendants had actual or constructive notice of conduct similar to the subject incident. Moreover, evidence of any prior assaults by the offending student against students other than the infant plaintiff may be sufficient to establish that the defendants had actual or constructive notice of the offending student's dangerous propensities. Next is Zupnik on page 15. It's another discovery case dealing with the inspection of property. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's request to enter the Rizzetta defendant's property to allow inspection and expert examination of the alleged diversion of water from the property onto a public road should have been granted. Plaintiff was injured riding his bicycle when he hit a patch of black ice and slipped and fell. The court wrote, CPLR 3120, subdivision 1, Roman numeral 2, provides that a party may serve another party with notice to permit entry upon designated land or other property in the possession, custody, or control of the party served for the purposes of inspecting, measuring, surveying, sampling, testing, photographing, or recording by motion pictures or otherwise the property or any specifically designated object or operation thereon. Motions seeking such discovery are routinely granted when a central issue in the case is the condition of the real property under inspection. Next is McGee Boyle versus Relia Star Life Insurance Company, which is on page 16. It just deals with the type of evidence needed for a motion to dismiss based entirely on documentary evidence. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant insurers, that's Realia Stars, motion to dismiss based on documentary evidence should not have been granted. Plaintiffs sued for breach of contract when Realia Star canceled a life insurance policy. The court wrote, in order for evidence to qualify as documentary, it must be unambiguous, authentic, and undeniable. Judicial records, as well as documents reflecting out-of-court transactions such as mortgages, deeds, contracts, and any other papers, the contents of which are essentially undeniable, would qualify as documentary evidence in the proper case. Conversely, letters, emails, and affidavits fail to meet the requirements for documentary evidence. ReliaStar submitted the policy and certain policy notices, which, according to ReliaStar, refuted the plaintiff's contention that the policy cancellation was the result of ReliaStar's breach of its obligations under the policy. The policy notices, however, were in effect letters, which failed to meet the requirements for documentary evidence within the meaning of CPLR 3211 subdivision A1. For the next case, we're skipping down to pages 19 and 20. It's Caliber Home Loans versus Silber. It has to do with the evidence necessary to rebut a process server's affidavit claiming proper service of process. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the process server's affidavit was rebutted by sufficient proof to warrant a hearing on whether the defendant, David, was served with the summons and complaint in this foreclosure action. The court wrote, a process server's affidavit of service gives rise to a presumption of proper service. Bare and unsubstantiated denials are insufficient to rebut the presumption. However, where a defendant submits a sworn denial of receipt of process containing specific facts to rebut the statements in the process server's affidavit, the presumption of proper service is rebutted and an evidentiary hearing is required. Here, an affidavit of service in which the process server attested to having served David with copies of the summons and complaint by personal delivery to him at his residence at the subject property in Williston Park on April 16, 2014 at 8:08 p.m. constituted prima facie proof of proper service on David. However, in support of the motion, David submitted an affidavit of Patricia, who attested that David suffered a brain aneurysm in April of 2008 and had resided in a nursing home in Glen Cove since July 2008 and thus could not have been personally served at the residence in 2014. These facts were supported by documents submitted with the affidavit, including minutes of a guardianship proceeding dated 2012, where the court noted that David resided in a nursing home in Glen Cove, so a hearing was necessary in that case. Again, I'm skipping down to page 24. I'm not going to record the summaries dealing with foreclosure. Foreclosure cases are pretty much a unique area of the law, and they often involved important civil procedure issues, but it's such a specialized area of the law, I'm not going to deal with them in this recording. However, all of those foreclosure summaries are included in the written materials, and obviously if you practice in that area, they're there for your review. So the next case is New Global Tex, which is on page 24. It deals with the appealability of a sua sponte order by a judge. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Supreme Court should not have sua sponte dismissed plaintiff's complaint and vacated the default judgment as untimely. Plaintiff had timely moved for a default judgment. Although sua sponte orders are not appealable as of right, the First Department deemed the notice of appeal as a motion for leave to appeal. The court wrote, an order issued sua sponte is not appealable as of right, and it cites Scholes v. Mager, 100 New York 2nd, 333. However, given the nature of the motion court's sua sponte relief in dismissing the complaint pursuant to CPLR 3215 subdivision C, we deem the notice of appeal to be a motion for leave to appeal and grant such relief, citing CPLR 5701 subdivision C. Next is Marti v. Rana on pages 24 and 25. It deals with the powers of a judge to hear a summary judgment motion. First Department held that it was appropriate for a judge to decide a summary judgment motion despite the fact that another judge heard the oral argument. The court wrote, the fact that oral argument was held before a different justice than the justice who ultimately decided the motion for summary judgment is not a proper basis for vacating the order granting summary judgment. Although Judiciary Law, Section 21, provides that a Supreme Court justice shall not decide or take part in the decision of a question which was argued orally in the court when he was not present and sitting therein as a judge, reversal is not warranted on this ground because the justice who granted the motion decided a purely legal question. Next is Cudzi v. Larios. It's on pages 25 and 26. It deals with the jurisdiction over several parties arising from an accident out of state. Second Department held Supreme Court properly denied one of the defendant's motions to dismiss premised on lack of personal jurisdiction pending further discovery. The traffic accident happened in New Jersey. Plaintiff's van was struck from behind by a freight truck leased by Finkel, a New Jersey corporation, from Ryder Truck Rental, and driven by defendant Larios, a resident of Pennsylvania. All the plaintiffs were residents of New York. The Second Department found that there was no general jurisdiction under CPLR 301 and no long-arm jurisdiction under CPLR 302 subdivision A3, which deals with a tortious act outside the state causing injury within the state. However, there may be jurisdiction against Finkel pursuant to CPLR 302 subdivision A1, which relates to conducting business within the state. The court wrote, plaintiffs have not alleged facts in opposition which would support the exercise of personal jurisdiction under New York's general jurisdiction statute, CPLR 301, over Larios, the driver, who is not domiciled in New York, or over Finkel. Finkel leased the truck that Larios was driving, which was not incorporated in New York and did not have its principal place of business in New York. Under CPLR 302 subdivision A3, the situs of the injury is the location of the original event which caused the injury, not the location where the resulting damages are subsequently felt by the plaintiff. Since the accident which caused the injuries occurred in New Jersey, CPLR 302 subdivision A3 does not provide a basis for personal jurisdiction over these defendants in New York. Finkel asserted that it is a New Jersey corporation with its business address in New Jersey, and Larios stated that at the time of the accident, he was transporting a load for the United States Postal Service within the state of New Jersey. However, Finkel admitted that it had terminals at four New York locations at which it parked its vehicles. Based upon these facts, and given Finkel's failure to submit trip logs, manifests, or other documentary evidence to support its assertion that the load Larios was transporting was being shipped within the state of New Jersey and had no relationship to Finkel's New York business, we agree with the Supreme Court's determination to deny as premature that branch of the appellant's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211 subdivision A8, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against Finkel, with leave to renew upon completion of discovery. At this point, I'm going to insert the first verification code in this CLE course, which is based on the civil procedure related decisions released by our New York State appellate courts in June of 2019. The first verification code is defective. Again, the first verification code for this June 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is defective. Next is another jurisdiction case. It is matter of Geneva Foundry litigation on pages 26 and 27. It has to do with toxic torts. The Fourth Department held the action alleging negligence and inverse condemnation stemming from toxic contamination of the vicinity of a defunct factory was properly dismissed because the allegations did not specify when the injuries occurred. The court wrote, "The state of New York is sovereign and has consented to be sued in strict accordance with the requirements of the Court of Claims Act," and it cites Court of Claims Act Section 8. "Among those requirements is the claimant's duty to allege the time when the claim arose. The requirements of Section 11B are jurisdictional in nature, and the failure to satisfy them mandates dismissal of the claim without regard to whether the state was prejudiced or had access to the requisite information from its own records. Although claimants adequately specified when defendants' negligent acts allegedly occurred, they failed to supply any dates or ranges of dates regarding their alleged injuries, such as when they were exposed to the toxins, when they developed symptoms, when they sought treatment, or when they were diagnosed with an illness. Instead, claimants alleged only the dates of their residence in Geneva and the dates when news of the contamination became public. Claimants' allegations are insufficient to enable defendant to adequately investigate the claims in order to ascertain its liability, if any." Next is matter of New York City asbestos litigation on pages 27 and 28. It's another jurisdiction case, this time involving the pleadings. First Department held defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint based upon a lack of personal jurisdiction was properly denied because the defense was waived when defendant did not specifically deny an allegation of general jurisdiction made in the complaint. The court wrote, "The allegations of plaintiff's complaint in paragraphs 83 and 84 purport to establish a basis for general jurisdiction. They were not denied by the defendant. Rather, defendant admitted them to the extent that it is a duly organized foreign corporation doing business in New York. Defendant's failure to clearly provide an objection to general jurisdiction in its answer waived the defense and conferred jurisdiction upon the court." Next is Cedar Run Homeowners Association on page 28. It has to do with the requirements for service of process on a limited liability company. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiffs did not demonstrate compliance with the service of process requirements of the limited liability company law. The court wrote, "Although plaintiffs proffered an unsigned receipt of service purportedly generated by the Office of the Secretary of State That receipt did not set forth the papers served, whether duplicate copies of those papers were delivered to the Secretary of State, the time of service, or facts showing that service was made by an authorized person. And it says, see Limited Liability Company Law, Section 303, Subdivision A, and CPLR, Section 306, Subdivisions A and D. Next is Matter of Rochester Genesee Regional Transportation Authority on page 29. It has to do with the appealability of a motion in limine. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the portions of a motion in limine seeking to strike parts of respondent's appraisal report in this condemnation proceeding should not have been granted. The court noted that the evidentiary issue was appealable, and in general, evidentiary rulings are not appealable until the a judgment. The court noted that the ruling was appealable in this case because it limited the scope of the trial issues. Next is Deutsche Bank National Trust Company on page 30. It's an important case because it deals with the failure to include a necessary party in the action and the court's power to bring the necessary party into the action on its own despite the passage of the statute of limitations. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's bank's second motion to extend the time to serve defendant, whose name is Bandalos, after the statute of limitations had run, should have been granted. The court further held Supreme Court should have summoned a necessary party, called Mother of Pearl, the record owner of the property, because the party was subject to the court's jurisdiction. The court wrote, Supreme Court should have granted that branch of plaintiff's motion, which was for leave to join Mother of Pearl as a party to the action. A party may move for judgment dismissing one or more causes of action asserted against him or her on the ground the court should not proceed in the absence of a person who should be a party, CPLR 3211, Subdivision A 10. However, CPLR 1001, Subdivision B provides that where the party is subject to the jurisdiction of the court shall order him or her summoned. Mother of Pearl, as the record owner of the property, is a necessary party to this action, citing CPLR 1001 Subdivision A and Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1311, Subdivision 1, subject to the jurisdiction of the court. Consequently, the court should have ordered Mother of Pearl summoned rather than granting that branch of the mortgagor's cross motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211 Subdivision A 10, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against them. Further, under the circumstances of this case, Supreme Court should have granted that branch of the plaintiff's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 306-B, for leave to extend the time to serve the summons and complaint upon Kelly Bandalos by publication in the interest of justice. While the action was timely commenced, the statute of limitations has since expired. Although the plaintiff's only excuse for not serving Kelly Bandalos by publication is law office failure, it did make diligent efforts to serve her prior to the first extension of time to serve and the issuance of the order of publication. Further, Kelly Bandalos had actual notice of the action within 120 days of its commencement. She served and filed an answer, and there's no identifiable prejudice to her attributable to the delay in service. Next is Backer and Associates, which is on page 31. It deals with the vacation of a note of issue and certificate of readiness, and also deals with discovery involving trade secrets. Fourth Department held the motion to vacate the note of issue should have been granted because the information in the note of issue and the certificate of readiness was not correct. The court further determined that the confidentiality stipulation was sufficient to protect trade secrets during discovery. The court wrote, contrary to the statements on the certificate of readiness, discovery was incomplete when the note of issue and certificate of readiness were filed. Thus, a material fact in the certificate of readiness was incorrect, and the note of issue and certificate of readiness must be vacated. Defendants requested that the court issue a protective order that included the designation of a third-party neutral expert and an attorney and expert eyes only designation for disclosure. The court denied defendants' request and directed the parties to execute a confidentiality stipulation and order and to proceed with discovery pursuant to Rule 11G of the Rules of the Commercial Division of the Supreme Court, and that is 22 NYCRR Section 202.70. The confidentiality stipulation and order provides that confidential information shall be utilized by the receiving party and its counsel only for purposes of this litigation and for no other purposes. Any violation of this stipulation and order may be enforced as a contempt of court. We conclude that the court provided defendants with adequate protection of their intellectual property and trade secrets. Next is Fadlala versus Yankee Trails World Tours. It's on page 32. It deals with an attempt to amend the complaint after the statute of limitations had run. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held plaintiff should not have been allowed to have more time to serve defendant and amend the complaint to substitute the correct defendant. The action stemmed from a traffic accident involving a bus owned by Yankee Trails. 5 days before the statute of limitations ran, plaintiff commenced an action against Yankee Trails World Tours, a different corporation with a different address and a different chief executive officer. The court wrote, whether relief pursuant to CPLR 306-B and 305 subdivision C is available is not merely a matter of discretion. Significantly, CPLR 306-B cannot be used to extend the time for service against the defendant as to which the action was never validly commenced. Similarly, although a court may allow amendment of a summons to correct the name of a defendant pursuant to CPLR 305 subdivision C, such remedy is not available where a plaintiff seeks to substitute a defendant who has not been properly served. The court went on, the fact that defendant and Yankee Trails used the same insurance carrier is of no significance in the circumstances presented. The record reflects that the insurance carrier did not contact Yankee Trails until after the statute of limitations had expired. Nor may we consider plaintiff's error a mere misnomer that would allow relief to be granted pursuant to CPLR 305 subdivision C and CPLR 306-B. Upon this record, plaintiff's attempt to proceed against Yankee Trails as an unserved and entirely new defendant after the statute of limitations had run should have been denied, as he failed to obtain jurisdiction over Yankee Trails for relief pursuant to CPLR 306-B, and thus to later amend the complaint pursuant to CPLR 305. Next is Matthews on page 33, and it deals with whether a moving party can make out a prima facie case by submitting information for the first time in reply. Second Department held that information provided for the first time in a reply affidavit could not be relied upon to sustain a moving party's prima facie case burden for a summary judgment motion. The plaintiff, who was injured on the job, alleged he was hired by the defendant Bright Star Messenger Service, which will be referred to as the appellant from now on. In its motion for summary judgment, the appellant alleged it was plaintiff's general employer and plaintiff's only remedy was workers' compensation. But included in appellant's papers was plaintiff's claim for workers' compensation benefits, which listed plaintiff's employer as Bright Star Courier. Therefore, the appellant failed to make out a prima facie case that it was plaintiff's employer. The appellant then submitted a reply affidavit stating that Bright Star Courier had changed its name to Bright Star Messenger Center prior to the accident. The court wrote, a party cannot sustain its prima facie burden by relying on evidence submitted for the first time in its reply papers. Next is the Abd El Fattah case. It's on page 34. It deals with the res judicata effect of a dismissal based on default, failing to appear. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, noted that the prior dismissal of plaintiff's action because the plaintiff failed to appear in opposition to defendant's motion was not a determination on the merits and therefore has no res judicata effect. The court said, an order entered upon a party's default in appearing to oppose a motion to dismiss is not a determination on the merits. Where a dismissal does not involve a determination on the merits, the doctrine of res judicata does not apply. Accordingly, the doctrine of res judicata does not apply to bar the instant action. Next is countywide flooring on pages 34 and 35. It's another res judicata case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the subcontractor's action seeking to foreclose a mechanics lien was precluded by the doctrine of res judicata, despite its being based on theories different from those raised in a prior action. The court said, under res judicata or claim preclusion, a valid final judgment bars future actions between the same parties on the same cause of action. Once a claim is brought to a final conclusion, all other claims arising out of the same transaction or series of transactions are barred, even if based upon different theories or if seeking a different remedy. Accordingly, a disposition on the merits bars litigation between the same parties or those in privity with them of a cause of action arising out of the same transaction or series of transactions as a cause of action that either was raised or could have been raised in a prior proceeding. While a subcontractor may have the right to file a second mechanics lien within the statutory time period, at least to cure an irregularity in a lien first filed, or to reassert a lien when the prior one has been lost by delay in its enforcement, a second mechanics lien is not immune from the doctrine of res judicata. Although the plaintiff framed its causes of action in the 2014 action as a breach of contract and unjust enrichment causes of action, and its cause of action in this action as one to foreclose a mechanics lien, these are merely different theories for the plaintiff's cause of action to recover monies allegedly owed it under the subcontract. Next is Finnegan on pages 35 and 36. It deals with the presumption of proper service created by a process server's affidavit. Second Department held Supreme Court should have held a hearing to determine whether the defendant corporation, Advanced, and its principal, Tramarco, were properly served with the summons and complaint. The presumption of proper service created by the process server's affidavit was rebutted by Tramarco's affidavit, stating that the place where service was made and any person at that location had no connection to him or his business. The court wrote, Tramarco submitted an affidavit in which he claimed that both he and Advanced were improperly served at a residence that he had sold to an unrelated third party 3 years ago. He further averred that on the date service was purportedly made, he had no relationship with any person at the residence, and no person at that address was authorized to accept service on behalf of Advanced. The Supreme Court should not have, in effect, denied that branch of defendant's motion, pursuant to CPLR 5015, subdivision A4, to vacate the judgment and dismiss the complaint without first conducting a hearing. Ordinarily, a process server's affidavit of service establishes a prima facie case as to the method of service and therefore gives rise to a presumption of proper service. Where there's a sworn denial that a defendant was served with process, the affidavit of service is rebutted and the plaintiff must establish jurisdiction at a hearing by a preponderance of the evidence. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code for this June 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE course, the second verification code is Yellowstone. Again, the second verification code for this 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE course is Yellowstone. Next, on pages 36 and 37, the Chaplin case, it has to do with the statute of limitations as it relates to toxic torts. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendants failed to demonstrate when the lead paint exposure cause of action accrued. Therefore, the motion for summary judgment on the ground that the statute of limitations had passed should not have been granted. The court wrote, neither defendant established the relevant accrual date of plaintiff's claims for injury caused by the latent effects of lead paint exposure, and in the absence of such evidence, neither defendant made a prima facie showing that the applicable limitations period had expired on those claims. Next is 255 Butler Associates. It's on pages 37 and 38. It deals with the power of a court to amend a stipulation. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the stipulation entered by plaintiff tenant, defendant landlord, pursuant to a Yellowstone injunction, should not have been modified by the judge. The defendant landlord notified plaintiff, the tenant, of several alleged defaults under the lease and subsequently notified the plaintiff tenant of the termination of the lease. Plaintiff tenant sued defendant landlord and moved for a Yellowstone injunction, which the court ordered. The parties entered a so ordered stipulation requiring plaintiff tenant to pay over $100,000 per month for use and occupancy of the property during the court proceedings. More than a year later, plaintiff tenant moved to modify the stipulation to reduce the monthly use and occupancy payments, and the court reduced the payments to zero. The court wrote, the so ordered November 2015 stipulation was negotiated by the parties and accepted by the Supreme Court, and as a result, may be considered a court order. Although the Supreme Court retains inherent discretionary power to relieve a party from a judgment or order for sufficient reason and in the interest of substantial justice, a court's inherent power to exercise control over its judgment is not plenary and should be resorted to only to relieve a party from judgments taken through fraud, mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. Nevertheless, under almost any given state of facts, where to enforce a stipulation would be unjust or inequitable, or permit the other party to gain an unconscionable advantage, courts will afford such relief. And the Second Department determined that there were no such special circumstances here, and the court did not have the power to amend the stipulation. Next is Queen on pages 38 and 39. It deals with the kind of evidence that can be allowed in a civil traffic accident case. It also deals with the proper procedure to order a new trial where the damages are deemed insufficient by the judge. Fourth Department noted that defendant in this traffic accident case should not have been allowed to testify that she didn't receive a traffic ticket. The court also noted that the trial judge properly determined the damages for past pain and suffering should be increased, but that the proper procedure is to order a new trial unless the defendant stipulates to the increased amount. The trial judge had unconditionally increased the damages amount. The court wrote, it is well established that evidence of non-prosecution is inadmissible in a civil action. In our view, however, that was the only error during trial. We conclude that, standing alone, that error was harmless, and therefore the court properly denied the motion insofar as it sought to set aside the jury verdict and a new trial on all issues pursuant to CPLR 2002. But the court went on, Plaintiff further contends that the jury's damages award for pain and suffering materially deviated from what would be reasonable compensation for plaintiff's injuries, and that the deviation was not cured by the court's increase of the award for past pain and suffering. We reject that contention. We conclude that the court properly determined that the jury's verdict for past pain and suffering should be increased to $125,000, and that the award for future pain and suffering did not materially deviate from what would be reasonable compensation for plaintiff's injuries, and it cites CPLR 5501 subdivision C. The court, however, erred in unconditionally increasing the past pain and suffering award. The proper procedure when a damages award is inadequate is to order a new trial on damages unless a defendant stipulates to the increased amount. Next, we're skipping down to page 40. This is the last case in this CLE course. It's the Ordentlich case, again on page 40. It has to do with the effect of a defective verification in the Court of Claims. Second Department held the fact that the notice of claim was not verified was properly overlooked. The court wrote, by notice of motion dated January 6, 2016, the claimant sought leave to amend their notice of intention to file a claim, or alternatively, for leave to file a late notice of claim. A proposed amended notice of an intention to file a claim was included with the motion, and it included the verification which was missing from the original. In the order appealed from, the Court of Claims granted the claimant's motion for leave to amend their notice of intention to file a claim. Pursuant to Court of Claims Act, Section 11, Subdivision B, a notice of intention to file a claim shall be verified in the same manner as a complaint in an action in Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals has held there is no basis for treating an unverified or defectively verified claim or notice of intention any differently than an unverified or defectively verified complaint is treated under the CPLR in Supreme Court. Here, as the Court of Claims found, the defendant was not prejudiced by the omission of a verification. Moreover, the court noted that CPLR 2001 permits an omission or defect to be corrected upon such terms as may be just. So that completes this CLE course, which is based on the New York State appellate decisions dealing with civil procedure issues that were released in June of 2019. The case summaries used here were originally posted weekly in June 2019 on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they were compiled into an organized update pamphlet, which serves as the written materials for this CLE course.